Okay, so I am, I guess the first thing I was going to just discuss short the survey results, not go through each of them. I sent you a link to this. You can read it yourself to get a feel for what, you know, people are thinking about. I normally make these available to everybody so that you get a feel for not just what you think, but what the class is thinking. And I am responding to what the overall class is thinking, not a single person. So you at least understand, you know, if you are really, really unhappy, but everybody else is happy, I can't do too much just for you. And the opposite also is true, okay? But you'll get an idea. And so anyway, these are the answers for the couple of questions I asked, and mostly people seem to be thinking that the class is going fine. There are some interesting constructive comments, but you know, overall it seems like people are generally okay. Lectures seem to be fine, and then these people made up huge numbers of hours that they're apparently spending on reading, and I was just so happy. so I don't believe it, but I just don't believe it. Anyway, but I hope so. I mean, I hope so. Okay. I mean, so, and then this is one of the things that we were discussing. I mean, you can, I mean, actually I'm going to summarize it in my slide, but you know, if you read this, there's only one person, I think, who said, I don't want Fridays, I want, you know, during the class, but pretty much everybody else said, let's have it on Fridays, the presentations be on Fridays so that class time can be saved. So that's at least what has been said there. So, you know, you got the, you know, information that I'm getting too. So if you are that one person who wanted it not on Friday, then you know, you can still try to, you know, if you cannot make that particular, you know, the thing, I mean, we may be able to do something just for that person, but in general, I'm probably going to schedule these on Fridays in the last month. Okay, so in November sometime, starting November sometime, we will have Friday meetings when, you know, per meeting, maybe two people or so will present. And by the way, before I go on that, I would try to give you the schedule. I mean, I'll try to tell you when these things will start. You have to sign up. And furthermore, the idea of this is, I mean, you know, those of you who have worked with me, and some of you have had the, you know, misfortune of doing so, I actually take presentations very seriously. So you have to send me the presentations you plan to make beforehand. Okay, I mean, normally what I would like to do is actually hear your rehearsal and then let it be presented. If it was going to be in the class, I would have really done that, because I don't want you to waste everybody else's time because your thinking is not clear, okay? And also, hopefully, you don't get that much of an training on how to give presentations, okay? So hopefully, to the extent I can help in that, I would like to do that. So if, you know, anybody who is going to present in the class would need to give me the slides 1 week before. Okay, 1 week before the deadline, and then I would get to, and then you have to meet with me, you know, on one of the office hours before to make sure, or on a separate time if that won't work, to make sure that I'm okay with it. Just don't send it and assume that I will tell you what to change, okay? I mean, this is one of the few things you'll hopefully will be learning in, you know, in actually doing, because, you know, not only just reading the paper, but, you know, saying, you know, how to give the presentation. So that's something that I'm saying it here, you know, I'm not necessarily going to say it separately in the email, but that's kind of required. So, I mean, I, you know, I'm on record. I mean, I think if, I don't know if, I think I sent you my mentoring talk on papers, and if you see the end of the talk, I said, most presentations are deadly dull and boring. That's what I believe, okay? And so it's, in fact, extremely hard to try and be engaging, and so, not extremely hard, extremely rare. It's not hard. I don't think it's hard, but it's rare for people to be, you know, engaging, okay? And I think there are ways of being engaging so that you can actually put yourself in other people's heads and make sure that they understand, you know, why they should read this paper, for example. You know, what insights will they get if they were to read the paper? Those are the kinds of things we'll try to do, okay? So that's one thing regarding the presentations, and they're likely to be, they're, as I said, not likely to be, they will be in on Fridays, you know, starting sometime in November. I will probably have like three presentations or so, two or three presentations. I'll look at the way the numbers work out per class, okay? Okay. And then this one is an interesting question as to whether or not people are worried that their entire grade depends on project and presentation and nothing else. Well, it's like there are two different answers to this. One is majority seems to be happy. I don't really care. It's fine. And for those who did, I asked, if you are worried, then do you think there should be a additional means of assessment such as a midterm and final? And our final, okay? And so if you read this, the same thing that I read, you can read. I think it's also in the next page. If you read this, you'll see that, I think majority of people said, yeah, that's fine. I'm comfortable with just talks and the project. But then those who actually had an opinion otherwise said, yeah, might as well have an extra assessment like midterm. And the only one person who said, no, it's legally illegal to change, and you're in the wrong class. Everything I do is legally illegal. I don't know. They didn't say exactly that. But, I personally think that there should be a sanity test. It's not a midterm. It's not a final. It's a sanity test. Okay? I would like to know that, at the end of this semester, I like to think that people got something out, okay? So my best idea right now is that, in fact, when I was in grade school, my father used to say that the teachers will hold exams whenever they need rough paper, because then we will write exams on the paper and then they can use the backs of the paper for doing their calculations. And I think my latest version is we should hold tests when the instructor is out of town. And I will be out of town on November 9th. And so I'm going to hold a sanity test that day. It will be closed book, okay, and it will be in class. And the questions would not be asking you to solve new theorems. It's basically, if you understood essentially what's going on in the class, you should be able to answer, okay? So for example, I'll just give you an idea. So for example, I could give you an MDP scenario and say, do one Bellman backup. You should know. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's like, if you don't even know that, that means essentially this is more for me than for you. I can use it against you too. If you just got a zero on that, that means you didn't really get anything out of the class. But I'm really hoping that I, at the end of the semester, I won't feel as if I just have no basis to give grades. In the best case where you have done a project which is sort of publishable in III, I'm happy, and I think you deserve your grade. But there's a possibility that, with all your best intentions, your projects would not necessarily get completed, or that your presentations may not be done. And at that point of time, I would be in the unenviable position of trying to figure out what is the basis on which to make your grade. And that's one reason. The other reason is I would like to think that if all this discussion that we are doing in the class, some of it is actually getting into your head. Right? And so I would not call it midterm, I wouldn't call it final, I would actually call it sanity test. Because it's not midterm, because it's November 9th, right? And it's not final, because it's on November 9th. And it's going to be a sanity test. And everybody who's sitting in the class has to take it. Our November 9th would be your last class. Okay? And basically this is to make sure that we are talking approximately the same language. Okay? So that's the deal. Okay, and I'll set up a test. It's hard for me. I hate tests, setting up tests, and it's harder to set up a test which is mostly to actually understand. This is supposedly kind of understanding whether you got the general point of these lectures. Okay, my assumption is that if you heard me and if you went through the slides, then you should be able to answer them. But you don't get to see the slides during the test. It will be closed book. Okay, it will be closed book, closed notes, in class. And then I will bring my burly grad students to proctor you. and then they'll make sure that you do your deal. Okay, but I think let's take it in a positive way, because I just really want to make sure that we are all, in this day of Google, everything is on the web. Okay, so the only difference between a learned person and a not learned person is what can you say before looking up on the Google. Okay. Still quite hard. I'm standing here right now. I need to be able to hold a conversation with you, and I can't keep checking on the Google, for every sentence. So that's more or less what I want. You know, I want you to be able to tell that you know what, you know, things, some of the things that we talked about in the class are. Okay, that's basically what I'm going to do. And if you really are mad at me for that, please feel free to send me an email. I mean, you know, but I'm going to do this. Okay, that's, and again, as I said, you know, everybody who is showing up for the class have to take that test. Okay, and then this one was what to do about the class. And in fact, one of the things that people did want is they want reinforcement of what they're learning. And, well, of course, one way of reinforcing is actually to set up projects for the entire class. You know, the problem with that, I mean, there are two different ones. One is, of course, I'm lazy. I have to set up projects, and one day I can set it up. The other is that you cannot really have time for a real, you know, good semester-long project if you also have to do structured projects that I set up. So it's only one, the other, either this or that. And normally in my classes, I just, you know, which I teach at 4-level, cross-listed with 598, I just make it very structured. And then I decide what the projects are. And then the graduate level courses, you know, which I teach once in a while, I basically make sure that, you know, you get to decide what your projects are. So that I agree that reinforcement would be great, but I basically, this is one way you can do that is actually the only thing that we currently have is presentation and the and your project, okay, and then this test that I'm going to give you for one class. Okay, and of course, November 9th test will only be about stuff that gets done up until then. Okay. Any questions on this? Yes?
There's no final.
No final. And I think, in fact, people did say, even of those people who said, yeah, maybe we should have some assessment, they said, I think one or maybe two. I mean, I was reading this asynchronously. Every once in a while, I'll see how many people have written anything, and I'll read this, and then I'll, you know, close it again. And so one or two people said, if you're going to have it, might as well have it in the middle of the semester rather than in the end, because end we'll be too busy completing the project. And I think that makes sense. Okay? So that's why it's going to be, and, you know, I guess I have this nice day, November 9th, and, you know, I can't make up classes anymore because you want all the Friday classes for the presentation. So November 9th is going to be that. So, other questions? Yes?
The paper reviews, are going to be considered for the final grade?
Yeah, that's considered part of the participation. Okay. But I mean, but the point is nobody is paying attention to the thinking caps. I sent a couple and I didn't know that it was being taken that seriously. You know, I have had undergraduate level classes where thinking caps, which didn't count for any grade, were taken way more seriously. You know, it's possible that you guys are really thinking hard, but, you know, you're doing a good job of not showing it. That's part of my worry that, you know, at the end of this thing, all I did got to do is give lectures. And I mean, really, you know, there is this classic saying that, what's his name? S. Chandrasekhar, Subramanian Chandrasekhar, the guy who found the, the black hole limit, right? What's the name? It's called Chandrasekhar limit, essentially. So he was one time, he was a, you know, astronomy professor at University of Chicago, and at one time, he had a graduate level seminar, you know, for which would be at 7:30 in the morning in Chicago, and he would just, you know, plow through the snow to come and teach, quote unquote, teach this seminar to two Korean students. That's it. Only two Korean students. That was the entire class. And then both of them got their Nobel Prizes before him. Okay, that's what graduate study is all about, really. So if one of you get a Nobel Prize, you know, got good paper, then I think I've done my duty. Okay, it's undergraduate. I know, that's really sad. So you should just get, like, you know, Turing Award or something. But really, the serious point is that I understand that, you know, if one of you get it, I'm happy. Okay, I mean, I think that's really the point of, you know, undergraduate study. But it is worth seeing if, you know, how much. I mean, given so many people are there, it would be worth making sure that, yes?
Actually, now that we're talking about this, I'd also like to say that since now we have two things, we have the blog and the wiki, I think it's become apparent that nobody's really visiting the blog too much, or at least leaving their footprint on it, because the wiki I think the blog also could be like a, not necessarily a fun thing, but something less formal than the wiki.
Mm-hmm.
You can post things related to AI, not necessarily.
I understand. I mean, all those things. I mean, I also started, remember that we had, I was originally hoping that people will actually write notes for the classes. Which, if you did, November 9th sanity test would have been easy. Now you will write it yourself. So, for each of you. What? I mean, good. That's good. So you can enjoy that too. So, as I said, you know, you guys may well be getting it all. And, you know, one day you will get Turing Award, but I'm just trying to get some idea that beforehand that you got some of it.
No, but my point essentially was that people may actually get something out of a particular class, but may not want to describe it like, you know, in a formal way on the wiki. That's what the blog is for. Like, if you had a...
I understand. Fine with me. Yeah, I mean, again, as I said, it's like, it's what you make it out to be. And I'm an observer as far as those are concerned. And my observation is that people are too busy, hopefully, thinking to write anything anywhere, which is fine. Okay, so that's where was there any other questions? Okay, so, you know, you can go through the rest of it yourself if you feel like, but otherwise, let's do the... Presentations, you will be using other people's time. So I'm particularly interested in making sure that you don't waste their time. I mean, not you, I mean, all of you. You know, everybody who gives presentations can waste people's time. And so even though it's outside the class time, they still showed up. You know, I mean, I think it's extremely important for a speaker to respect the audience time. And I think, you know, so I want to help in that, okay? As far as the project report is concerned, I think I will not, I mean, in ideally, if we are submitting it somewhere, I would like to go over multiple iterations. If you get done with your project report like 15 days before the deadline and show it to me, I will be happy to give you comments on it. But I won't require it because I know that many of you are likely to write it in the last day. And so I don't know. What can I do? Okay.
So
yes.
We have about 15 or 20 minutes for the presentation.
I think so. No, and that's for the presentation. For the projects, I haven't decided. We did not say there will be actual presentation for the project results.
Oh,
we did not say it. So, I mean, I need to see how much time is there for, I mean, it would be actually nice to have presentations on the project results, and in particular, people can ask for it, you know, ask for a slot, but projects, normally, I assume I will be reading your reports. What? That's what, about 20 minutes. About 20, yeah, I think, yeah. Yeah. I think it's like three presentations at most, I mean, at least three presentations per class is probably what it's likely to work out to be. And it's 1 hour, 15 minutes. So, okay, between 20 and 30 minutes is what we'll have. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so so this is just basically, I told you this already. So what I am going to discuss this week is about preferences, okay? And basically today's class, it's like mostly very quickly go through chapter 16, and then on Wednesday's class, very quickly go through the other paper, okay? I assume that all of you have already read chapter 16, and at least some of you have read also the second paper. As I said in my mail, the way to understand the difference between them, one way, I mean, there are multiple ways, in fact, because that one also is a long paper. One way to understand the difference is that this basically, the 16, chapter 16 is like probability theory, atomic probability theory. And you can think of what is happening in that other paper as structured, you know, representation for preferences. So for example, we had probability theory and Bayesian networks, okay? And in particular, actually, the way we went from probability theory to Bayesian networks is we first figured out that if there are n variables, let's say n Boolean variables, right, you never need more than 2 power n minus 1 numbers to represent the joint distribution, and nobody can ever ask you a probabilistic query that cannot be answered once you have the joint distribution. So all you ever need is the joint distribution, and the basic atomic probability theory tells you how to compute any random probabilistic query, some of which will have conjunctive queries, some are conditional probabilistic queries, and some are disjunctive queries, and any of them can be computed once you have the joint distribution. Okay, and then we decided, well, this is fine, well and good for like undergraduate or like maybe high school level probabilistic reasoning, but the big problem in using these is, where do you get 2 power n minus 1 numbers? There's too many numbers. Okay, and in fact, if you remember from the 471, and by the way, one person said, you keep saying if you remember for 471, I don't remember anything from 471 because I didn't take it with you, sorry, but you know, I did require 471 to be the prerequisite, and some of you did take 471, and so you're suffering through me again second time, but you know, for those of you, I think you remember that we talked about two reasons why this is not good enough. One is, you need too many numbers, and you need wrong kind of numbers. Right? The too many numbers is, you need 2 power n minus 1 numbers. And you need wrong kind of numbers because the normal joint distribution assumes that if you have a1 to an, then it requires probabilities of the form a1 is true, a2 is false, a3 is true, a4 is false, a5 is true, etc., etc. What is the probability of that atomic event occurring? And if you need to get this number, it's pretty painful because these are the entries of the joint distribution, and it's not obvious how to assess them in the world. Remember that ultimately these can come either by asking experts or by learning in the case of probabilities. Right? You can learn the probabilities, or you can ask the experts to provide this. And it turns out in both ways, these are bad numbers. In fact, mostly you will ask experts, and experts would not tell you probabilities of the form A1 is true, A2 is false, A3 is true, etc. You know, more than about 10 of these, they'll ask you. What they can answer instead is, what's the probability that A1 is true given A5 and A6 are true? Those are the probabilities that they would like to give you. Right? So there are too many numbers and the wrong kind of numbers. To deal with the wrong kind of numbers, you consider conditional probabilities. Okay? And to reduce the numbers, you consider independence assertions. Conditional independence assertions. Now, of course, you can have direct independence. That means A is completely independent of B, in which case, in fact, the best possible case for n Boolean variables is if all of them are completely independent of each other, in which case you just need n numbers instead of 2 power n minus 1 numbers. Okay? But that's too good to be true. And in fact, we talked about this in 471, that if in fact you live in a world, God forbid, where everything is independent of everything, you may as well stop doing anything, because whatever you do won't affect anything in the world. You see what I'm saying? In fact, there better be dependencies in the world. We tend to think dependencies are the bad things. They're actually the good things. That's how you change the world. If everything is independent of everything else, then whatever you do is not going to change anything other than just that one variable. Okay? But you hope that everything, while you don't hope that everything is independent of everything, while we shouldn't hope that everything is independent of everything, neither should we want a world where everything is dependent on everything, because that's the worst case scenario where you will have 2 power n minus 1, and so anything you change, the rest of the world can change completely. So you're hoping that there are some sort of independences, conditional independences. For example, given that you have a cavity, toothache is independent of what's the other one? You know, toothache is independent of
weather.
If you have cavity, toothache is independent of what is the other one?
No,
that's one thing, but even in the, I'm not a dentist, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think the point is the weather,
Yeah, the catch, cavity and catch. That's the thing. So the idea is the dentist will put this catch to see if you have a cavity. And if the catch catches, then that means you have a cavity. Now, if you know that you have a cavity already, then the probability that you have to take is independent of the probability that you have catch. Right? And that's an independent assumption. That is not a complete independence, that is a conditional independence assertion. And we looked at those because those were actually easier. You know, they were less restrictive assumptions on the world. Okay? And then we went from here, to graphical models, which are Bayesian networks and Markov random fields. Of course, we certainly did the Bayesian networks. We mentioned Markov networks in passing. And all they were doing is that if you have a huge number of conditional independence assertions, they provide a compact way of representing them. And if you have a single Bayes network, then in essence, there is a simple idea which basically says in a Bayes network, so we know that, for example, C will be independent of all its ancestors given its immediate parents. That's one conditional independence assertion. But having given some conditional independence assertions, you can then derive other conditional independence assertions. In fact, it turns out that there can be exponential number of conditional independence assertions, many of which are redundant in the sense that they deductively follow from the given conditional independence assertion. So in the case of Bayes networks, you just show the direct ones, and there are this DCEP, you know, algorithm, and the Bayes ball, whichever you like, which basically will allow you to automatically tell whether or not a set is independent of another set given a third evidence set. Right? This entire thing is the review of probabilistic networks. Okay? Now it turns out that you can essentially, in sort of an analogical fashion, wherever I said probabilities, say utilities. And there is an entire development in this way. So you first of all can say if you have an n variable, n state variable world, that is you have n Boolean state variables, then you have 2 power n states in such a world. And to provide complete specification of your utilities, you need to provide 2 power n numbers. It's not even 2 power n minus 1 numbers anymore, because in the case of probability, all of them should add up to 1. In the case of utility, there is no such constraint, right? So you need to tell me how good is each of the states of the world is to you, right? Okay, so you will wind up getting 2 power, you know, in basically you will be winding up needing 2 power n utility numbers. You were thinking previously, oh my god, I have 2 power n probability numbers. I just have state variables, you know, a1 to an, and I have to give 2 power n probability numbers. But now that's not enough, because you might actually have differing preferences about how good a state is. And so really you also need to give me the state utility of the state, not just how likely the state is, but how useful the state is for you. And to do decision theory, you need the usefulness times the likelihood, which will be the expected value. Yes?
So actually, this is interesting. Going back to in the Russell Norman book, right, the first chapter, where they make the difference between the kinds of agents, like intelligent agent versus rational agent.
Decision theoretic agent.
So you can think of the probability that an agent that just thinks,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't do action in the world. And then this utility-based agent would be the rational agent, which does actions, the best action expected in the world. And then an agent that multiplies probabilities with the utilities to get expected is the ultimate, the decision theoretic agent that they have.
Yes. So to provide the decision theoretic agent, yes, in the Russell's terms, you would need, obviously, probabilistic logic and utility theory, both, not just one. In fact, one of the interesting questions you should ask yourself is, why did we not think about preferences all that much? In AI, we don't tend to think about preferences all that much. In the rest of the world, they do. I mean, in your normal life, you do, right? I mean, I don't like this very well. and then I like something else. So for example, if you take IR, you know, if you take information retrieval courses, there are preferences that users have when they give this two keyword query. But they would basically, and based on their preferences, they will then look at the answers and say which answers are good. And the search engine's responsibility is to rank the results such that this unknown preference metric of the users is actually, is actually satisfied. So not only do you have, we know that there are preferences, but sometimes we also know that people don't even give the preference information directly. That's a big issue. In fact, in this week, you know, both today's class and next class, especially the next paper, there's an entire section in the second paper, the last one third of it is all about learning preferences. Okay? I mean, learning probabilities versus preferences. Why is learning preferences more painful than learning probabilities? Actually, I mean, this is a good, I mean, no, it's not so much. I mean, so I have to learn probabilities. I have to sample. I have to learn preferences. I have to sample there too, somehow. Okay? I mean, basically, all of us will make, if you're doing sampling and learning, then you're generalizing based on some things that you've seen. Okay? So you should be able to generalize for preferences too. And I would still say preferences are a more painful thing for an autonomous system than probabilities. Yes? Basically, the point is that the dynamics of the system are independent of the user. Preferences, on the other hand, are based on the user. So when you say learning preferences, you need to learn the preferences for every random bozo who wants to use this system. So imagine you are in the blocks world, okay? To understand whether certain actions will, what will be the outcomes of certain actions, they don't depend upon the people, you know, who want certain black hole tasks to be done. So either, you know, red block can stay on top of a blue block or not. And if it stays 90% of the time, you can learn it by just looking at the domain. However, some people want to build blue stacks. Some want to build red stacks. Some want all the blocks on the table. Some want to put them in some sort of a, you know, order such that it spells their name. Each of them have different preferences. Do you see what I'm saying? So the question then is that when you're saying preference learning, you do it for each person. And in fact, preference learning is often, you have to do one extra level of assumption before it even becomes feasible. You would say, you fall in a user population, because otherwise you will be learning for each user. Mm-hmm. Unless your job depends on your boss, a single boss, who just finds your, you know, paycheck, and you're a secretary for your boss, in which case all you care about is your boss's preferences. You know, your boss wants 2 spoons of sugar in her coffee. Your boss wants something else in, you know, the paper to be put on the left-hand side of the desk, not the right-hand side. That's all you need to learn. But if on the other hand you're a search engine, right, or if you're a robot which has more than one boss, you know, different people can give different goals, then you need to either learn all their preferences or each of them need to specify their preferences. Until now, we completely punted that issue by saying every problem comes with a goal. Okay, so in blocks world, I will say the goal is to put A on top of B on top of C. But really what I want to say is different people might have different preferences. Some people want to stack blocks, some people want to, you know, arrange them in things, and more interestingly, you can have a complex preference. You know, keep doing something in the blocks world such that I have good visual feel. So it's like if you are a screensaver for the blocks world, right? So for a while, you'll put Rav in these nice wavy letters, and then you will put Rav coming from top to bottom. That's my preference, okay? And somebody else might want Tetris kind of blocks falling, for example. That would be their preference. And, you know, this agent has to make all of them satisfied. You know, basically, should be able to learn the preferences and satisfy them. So to be able to learn, you need to be able to represent the preferences. So both the second paper in particular first talks about how to represent preferences, what are the languages for representing preferences, and then now that I can represent it, when I say learn, I have to learn it for each person. Each user might have separate preferences, and I need to learn their preference, you know, metric from them. Yes?
preferences that are general, like patterns, as you said, the blocks world, how would you possibly do that? Like, if you're an MVP, sure, there's a set of states that all have that met. But once you've learned one preference for a state, you can't even begin to learn another preference for a different state if there's a pattern between them until you've reached that state. So how do you represent knowledge that can say, like, well, I like blocks that, you know, there's three red blocks in a row, they're stacked on top of each other. It doesn't matter where in the block sequence that is, as long as that's met, there's a preference for that.
Yeah, so that's basically, no, the point is actually MDPs already provided you that. You know, MDP said each state has a reward.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay,
that,
and that, you know, so if you went through a good state, you get the reward for that state.
Right, but that doesn't help you figure out the next state that also shares that pattern. How do you extract the knowledge for one preference that you've learned from one state that you've seen to other states in which that pattern would still...
No, that's, okay, so that's a good question. In the sense, you're talking about generalizing, you know, the learning. First, before that, I even want to actually represent preferences. I mean, I'm not saying this is not a good question. It's just that till now, we didn't even talk about preferences in this class. And you've done 471 without asking about preferences. It's as if everybody knows what the goal is, and you just achieve the goal fast or achieve the goal optimally. But preferences is, what are your goals? Okay? And we will spend some time actually, just as I said, probabilistic models don't exist yet for first order representation. Okay? And similarly, iterative models don't exist for some of these situations. Okay? So that paper that you get to read, and I hope you start reading, basically is like less than a year old. It's like in the beginning of this year, I think. And, you know, it's a state of the art tutorial on the structured preference models. Okay? And, you know, in fact, generalization issues are important. In fact, we'll hopefully next class talk about these issues involved in learning preferences given some idea, you know, some of the samples, and they will be connected to, obviously, machine learning, okay? I mean, because you're learning. But you need to know what are the hypotheses, you know, each learning you need to have a hypothesis space, and what kind of preference metric are you trying to look for so that you can generalize the examples. Yes? Yes, yes. So the point is, previously, all we said was somebody will give you for each state S its value, its reward. So in fact, one of the funny things is, notice that I'm doing 16 after having completed 17, which was the sequential decision problem. Okay. So what happens is, you know, the way the world is, when you go to 17, you would think you would use everything in 16. But no, in fact, 17 mostly in the textbook, 17 actually used atomic representations of probabilities and atomic representation also of utilities. Okay, and that's why we extended 17 by talking about factored representation of probabilities. We talked about LRT, DP, etc., which can at least, our FF replan, FF hop, which can use factored representation. But we didn't spend too much time in talking about preferences there. Okay, just as for probabilities, we actually talked, so if you think about what is needed from the probability chapters to understand chapter 17, you don't need to know Bayes networks. You didn't even need to know Bayes rules. Right? Right? Because each action was given its explicit probability of transition to new state. Okay, now does that mean they're all useless? No. Because those were useful to go to the factored representation of domain dynamics. Similarly, if you are thinking about what happened in 17, the utilities, which are basically black box utilities, for each state there's a reward. Given that, you figure out what is the expected, you know, aggregate reward that you can get from a given state. Okay, you never asked, how did you decide that this is the reward for this state? We are used to taking it. You know, somebody gives the number, we just take it. Okay, so now we're going to ask, actually, why do we believe that, in fact, there is a reason, if you think that utilities correspond to what user likes and doesn't like, then why do you think that preferences can actually correspond to real valued numbers called utilities? Okay, so it's that previous part which we are going to do today. So 16 is supposed to be before 17, but 17 doesn't really use everything in 16. Neither does it use everything in the Bayes network, our Bayes rule. So, you know, textbook goes up and down in terms of atomic versus propositional versus factored. Not just in dynamics, but also in preferences. That's the interesting part. Until now, you knew that it was going up and down in dynamics. But now you're also going to find out that it also goes up and down in preferences. Okay? Yes, sir.
Are preferences Markovian? Are we assuming that preferences are Markovian?
No. Today's class, we actually want to talk about preferences as first-class objects. So you can ask all these questions at that point of time. Okay? But we didn't even have them as first-class objects before. It was just always under the table. You know, we just use it. Okay? So I'm trying to make sense of why are we discussing this right now in this order. Okay? Okay, so you would talk about, if in the simplest case, if you're thinking about structured probabilistic, I mean, structured utility models, you would need at least one utility for each state. Okay? And furthermore, if the states are actually, if you know which state you are in, then you know what its utility is. But suppose I give you an action which can take you with some probability to this state and some other probability to this other state, and a separate action which takes you to this state with some probability and this other state with another probability, which one is the better action? Now, of course, you say, of course, it's expected value. You know, maximum expected value action is what you're supposed to pick. That theory is being discussed in this chapter first time. Okay? Okay, so then you wind up, if you're thinking in terms of, you know, opaque state models, you will need at least 2 power n utilities. Okay, now to reduce the number of utilities, and by the way, I can argue here too that not only do you need 2 power n utilities, but you also need, you need too many utilities and you need bad kind of utilities. Because people are likely to tell you that, oh, if I'm buying a Japanese car, I would rather it be a Toyota. Rather than say that a Toyota with 25,000 miles, which was made in 2001 and has two dents on the back, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this, this particular car is worth exactly 0.75 good for me, which is basically what joint utility value should be asking you. Just as you have joint probability, you have joint utility. And the point is that if you're asking people for their preferences, they're likely to express it in these conditionalized forms rather than in terms of this car is as good, this good, this car is this good. So you could almost argue that you need independence assumptions here too. And in fact, in the end of today's chapter, as well as the next paper, they talk about two kinds of independence, right? Mutual independence of preferences, MPI, and mutual conditional independence of preferences, MCPI, which correspond to normal independence probabilistically and conditional independence probabilistically. I mean, they only correspond in an analogical sense. There are interesting differences. So for example, here, as I said, you can't have 2 power n minus 1 numbers. You need all 2 power n numbers because there is no requirement that utilities should add up to some number. Okay? And similarly, here too, it turns out that the utility independence is different from probabilistic independence. Okay? And they don't necessarily follow the same kinds of rules. But the motivation for looking at utility independence rules is the same as motivation for looking at the probabilistic independence rules, to reduce the number of numbers you need. Okay? And then after that, you can say, well, I have some conditional independence assumptions. How can I represent these in some form? And you can talk about graphical models. And another interesting thing is, in probabilities, if you have a bunch of events, all of which are independent, their joint probability is multiplication. In probabilities, we love multiplication. If things are independent, you get to multiply their probabilities. In utilities, if a bunch of things are independent, the joint utility would be summation. So in utilities, we love summation. Just as we talk about product models in probabilistic reasoning, and then try to simplify them. Remember when we went from joint distribution written as in terms of chain rule to Bayes networks, we said certain, you know, chain rule expressions get simplified because of the underlying conditional assumption independences in the Bayes network, right? The same thing we do for utilities. except we are thinking in terms of adding, not subtracting. Okay, so in fact, the simplest kind of utility functions in when you have multiple attributes, there is this whole business of attributes that's being talked about in chapter 16 as well as the next paper. What are attributes? Attributes are state variables. And we were considering Boolean state variables, but you could have multi-valued state variables. Okay, and so if I give you an entire state which says A is true, B is false, C is true, D is false, blah, 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 what is its utility? If it turns out this domain, everything is independent of everything in terms of preferences, preferentially independent, then you have a number for how good A is if it is true for you, right? And then a number for this and this and this, you add them all up. A more generalized one might be essentially saying alpha times the first one plus beta times the second one plus gamma times the third one. It's a general additive model. Okay, so in general, what we would think of as products and probabilities are summations in utilities. And you always like to make the summation simpler and simpler. Okay. And when we get to the second, I mean, much of what we are doing today actually is really kind of set up the stage for the second paper, because the first paper you already read, and the first chapter you already read, it's a textbook really, and we'll go through it quickly, but in trying to see the second one, it's useful to understand why they do what they do, okay? And that analogy is very powerful between probabilities and utilities. But, you know, when you set up analogies, you also want to know the differences. Those are important too, okay? So for example, the probability that A is true, let's say, is 0.5. I mean, probability A is true is 0.7. What is the probability that A is false? 0.3. I really love A to be true. That means I love it. I would be 17 happy if A is true. How much would I be happy if A is false? You don't know. You need that number too. There are analogies, there are also a breakage of analogies, and you need to understand both, okay? And that's how you kind of get, you know, the structure of the development of the theory there. Okay, so that's the big picture of utilities and why we are, and then much of what we are doing today is in the probability scale, this part. Remember, I think chapter 13 in the probability theory, basically it says, if you have uncertainties, why do you even think that probability theory is a reasonable way of reasoning with uncertainties, even if you were to represent uncertainties in atomic level? And what are the axioms? Why should it be that probability should be between 0 and 1? That's an axiom. That's fine, okay? If you want it that way, that's fine. Okay? More importantly, this big problem. Why is it that A or B is probability of A plus probability of B minus probability of A and B? Why is this the case? Remember, we argued this in 471. In fact, the textbook actually provides a very beautiful reason why it should be the case, because Definity essentially provided a sort of a definitive argument, excuse the pun, basically saying, if you don't believe this, I'll set up a lottery where I'll get all your money. That's the way. You know, you can have your beliefs, okay? Just you'll be poor. And that would be fine, you know. So that's the way they actually prove. Remember, that's the way they show that this is a reasonable axiom to have. Probability of A or B should be defined this way, because if you define it any other way, I can set up a lottery where I'll get all your money. And we will get these arguments today too, as you saw in today's chapter. If you do not believe in certain reasonable properties of utilities, preferences, then I will set up lotteries where I get all your money. And you'll just happily give it and then, you know, live on the roads. Okay? And if you don't mind it, that's okay. You know, but otherwise, so that's like a hard, you know, real price to pay for not believing. I mean, I wish there is such a thing for evolution too. So that, you know, so that we won't have this Jerry Falwell nonsense argument. But anyway, but there is a good way. I mean, if you don't believe in evolution, you'll lose all your money. In a way where it would not be legal. You would take part in this lottery and you lose all your money. And that's the great argument about, you know, that as well as some of the axioms we're setting up for preferences, right? Okay, So basically in 13 we talked about why is this a reasonable set of axioms for probability theory. In 16, the beginning part of 16, we talk about why is a certain set of axioms, these axioms about preferences, a reasonable set. And once they are a reasonable set, then it turns out there is a theory which says then there exists a number system, basically a utility number for each state, such that, you know, any state which is more preferred than another state would have a higher utility in this case. So it's the theory that's built up in 16. And you as an AI guy are less interested in the theory. You know, you already assume probability theory is working. I just want to use fewer parameters that I need to learn. So that's why the second paper is way more interesting for you than the first chapter. But you need to understand both. Okay, so let's go through this as quickly as I can. And so preferences, basically, they think in terms of preferences over uncertain outcomes, okay, which is the more general case. In fact, the interesting thing is that in the second paper, it's only at the very end they talk about preferences over uncertain outcomes. Until then, they talk about preferences over certain outcomes, which is an easier case, which these guys don't think particularly highly of. But it turns out that is hard enough in actually providing structured representation. Okay, so if you have uncertain outcomes, then essentially the way you decide between, you know, these is you think in terms of lotteries. If you have multiple actions, so you may like A some amount, B some amount, and if there's one action which gets you to A and B in different probabilities, another action gets you to A and B with a different C and D with different probabilities, then the question is, which lottery do you prefer? Okay, now a deterministic outcome saying how much do you like A is still a lottery. It's a lottery where with probability 1 you get A and probability 0 you get B. So it's lottery idea is more general than deterministic question. Okay, so they start talking about these lotteries. And the notations in general are you can have preferences over individual elements themselves and you can have preferences over lotteries. Okay, so this is A is preferred to B, strictly preferred to B, A and B, I'm indifferent. That means I don't really care which I get. And this one is A is at least as preferred as B, right? And then if you have preferences, if a rational agent has preferences, okay, now by the way, these A and B can be deterministic events or they can be lotteries. See, A here could be this lottery, for example. Okay, so that's the nice thing. It's a more general theory than just deterministic event. Okay, deterministic state. And so all that preference theory, decision theory requires is that preferences satisfy some reasonable, simple reasonable constraints. Okay, what are the constraints? One is orderability. If A is preferred more than B, or if A is preferred, so orderability essentially says if it's a total preference model, that means everything given A and B, either A is more preferred than B, or B is more preferred than A, or you think they are both equal. There is no don't know. This is, in fact, a theory of complete preferences. Turns out that in the second paper, one of the interesting things is you realize that in the real world, you always are stuck with incomplete preferences. So we are talking mostly here about complete preference models. But you know, if you have a complete preference model, it should be orderable. It should be transitive. It's a reasonable requirement. If A is preferred to B, B is preferred to C, then A should be preferred to C. Now, if you say, I don't like this, I have preferences which don't follow that rule, then they'll tell you how to set up a lottery where you lose all your money. Okay, you will take part in it. You have no real reason not to take part in it, and you will keep losing all your money. Okay, so that's the way they argue that it's a reasonable thing to have transitivity. Continuity, if A is preferred to B and B is preferred to C, this is a very interesting thing actually. If A is preferred to B and B is preferred to C, then there exists a lottery over A and C which is as good as B. What does this tell you? This actually tells you that utility is all that you ever need to know about a state. I mean, we're going with these preferences, we are sort of going towards utility. Okay, so the idea is that if A is always preferred to B and B is always preferred to C, then there is a lottery between A and C where by playing with the parameter P, that the probability P, you can make the lottery's preference be equal to that of B. Right? That's basically the continuity. And substitutability is, if A is indifferent to B, then wherever A occurs, you should be able to put B. And monotonicity essentially says that if A is preferred to B, then any lottery where A and B are the two outcomes, except they differ that in the probability of P here, probability of A here is greater than the equal to the probability of A here, then this should be preferred at least as much as this. Okay? These are axioms. And you can say, I don't like the axioms, and about the only thing you will lose is all your money. You know, but if you agree with this, and these look like very reasonable axioms, then I can say that you should be able to provide, given preferences satisfying these constraints. Okay, so if I give you preferences, so suppose there is n state model. So I have three state variables, so that means there are eight states. And I ask you to tell me, okay, you prefer A to B, B to C, etc. So all pairwise preferences. Okay, you gave me all possible pairwise preferences. And they satisfy these constraints. Okay, then I should be able to find a mapping from states to real numbers, such that that's the utility number, such that if U of A is greater than or equal to U of B, then A is preferred, and you know, more are, you know, equally preferred to B. Okay, but this is a pretty strong requirement in the sense that now I'm basically saying, from your preference model, I'm giving you a cardinal utility. That means now I know exactly how good the state is, not just which is better than which. One of the interesting questions that you might have is, why must I need to know? So there are two ways of providing. If I have eight states, is it completely enough if I tell you the total ordering on the eight states that I have in my head? Or must I also tell you how big is the utility for each state? How much do I like each of the states? It turns out that when you have lotteries, when you have probabilities, the actual numbers matter. Okay, in fact, one of the interesting things is, before we learned about utilities back when we were doing min-max, we knew that if you take a min-max tree, okay, which has evaluation values in the bottom, okay, and so basically, and then you mins and maxes to take the best option, right? Suppose I give you an affine transformation. That means I basically, you know, multiply each thing by some constant and add some other constant to it. So everybody's leaf values have changed exactly the same way. Would the best action change? In min-max trees, okay, so if in min-max trees, so the idea is that I have, so a max is trying to decide, and then there's min, and then there's max again, right, and then I had 2, 3, 4, 5, let's say, right, in which case this will become 2, and this will become 4. Okay, and then so this guy will pick 4. That was the normal min-max. Now suppose I did an affine transformation y equal to mx plus c for everybody. Would obviously the numbers here in the bottom change, the backed up values change, but really what you care in the game is what action do you take next. Will that change? No. Right? So for deterministic cases, all you need is ordering. So there is in ranking, there are these two ideas, ordinal versus cardinal. Ordinal basically means you just have a total ranking at best. Cardinal tells you how big is one guy who is better than the other guy is. Right? And you know, in fact, we do both of these. In fact, we go too crazily with the ordinal ranking. So for example, if one presidential candidate gets one extra vote than the other presidential candidate, then one guy is a winner, the other guy is a loser. So presidential races are completely ordinal, right? And you know, at the state level too, they are actually ordinal, you know, because in the electoral college, the states, most states give all their votes to the winning candidate. So in fact, there are ways in which you can win US presidential election with just about 50 extra votes compared to your opponent, as long as they're properly placed. It's not exactly 50, because there are some states like Nevada, I think Nebraska, which gives it proportionally. But most states give it just winner takes all. And so in fact, to win the US presidential election, all you need is 50 carefully placed votes. In fact, less than that actually, because you only need the majority. Okay, so that's ordinal. Cardinal, on the other hand, is when I give you a midterm exam, I just don't tell you are better than this person, is better than this person. I'll tell you are 99 good, you are 97 good, you are 93 good. Of course, the numbers I made up, they're bogus, but you feel good that I gave you some number. Right? I mean, IQ is the same thing. You know, instead of saying this person seems more intelligent than this person, you'll say this person is 153.7897 intelligent compared to this other person who is 153.4757 intelligent. Okay? Now the interesting thing is, for deterministic cases, all you need is ordinal utilities. Now, in game theory, we actually talked about what is called expectimax. What's expectimax? Basically, it's a min-max where people get to also actually, people don't just get to make the move they want, they first have to toss a dice. And then based on that, they'll decide which moves they can make. Okay? So in particular, then basically, when you are doing that, each action you pick is a lottery. And so you are trying to say, instead of saying in chess, you're deciding what move to make. And a move is, for most people who don't have shaky hands, they're deterministic. You put the piece in one place, it's there. Okay, if on the other hand I get to say either I'll pick a card from this bunch here or this bunch here, those are two different moves, their outcomes are not determined because it depends on what's in that cards and what's in this cards. Right? So you're actually choosing between lotteries. Okay? And when you're choosing between lotteries, in fact you can go back and read the game theory chapter, there was a whole argument saying in the case you have, you know, expectimax, you know, those cases can be direct generalization of min-max search, okay, where you take expectations in the middle. Except one difference is you no longer can do affine transformations on utilities. The utilities actually have meaning, the numbers have meaning. Because by affine transformation, you can change the lottery that would become optimal, which is the main thing we're talking about. Okay, now of course, this is obviously, you know, getting a number for each thing is more general than ordinal. So if I have cardinal, I also have ordinal. If I have ordinal, I don't necessarily have cardinal. Right? So because these guys mostly talk about uncertain events from the beginning itself, they're talking about lotteries from the beginning itself, they focus essentially on cardinal utilities. And the next paper sort of starts all over again and says, sometimes I only need value functions which are just basically ordinal utilities. Okay, so that's the difference that we're talking about. Okay, so in the case of this, then if you have utility one is greater than other, then you know, you pick the one which has the higher utility, higher expected utility. Okay, that's the theorem, that's maximizing expected utilities. Now, let's see, where is the... So the... Let me see, somewhere I missed. Actually, the guys who did this, by the way, I wish it was there in the, yeah, this one. Von Neumann and Morgenstern. Who is Von Neumann, by the way? What? Yeah. Except that's like the least of his interesting things. I mean, we CS Bozos think that's the biggest thing he ever did, but he is a total polymath. And he has done tons of different things. And he was actually, if you read the book on, My Beautiful Mind, A Beautiful Mind, you'll see that Nash was actually at some point of time trying to impress Von Neumann, because that guy is extremely sharp and couldn't brook stupidity, you know. So he would just basically cut you down to pieces, you know, if you make any mistake. And Von Neumann doesn't necessarily think that Nash did anything useful. And so that actually makes him go even crazier. But anyway, von Neumann and Morgan Stern actually talked about game theory. They are connected to min-max. And so Nash came after them, and they said, basically Nash talked about Nash equilibria, but which is actually a weaker form of equilibrium for multi-agent games, because the strict domination equilibria are not available all the time. Okay, so that's why he became more famous, because Nash equilibria are there for any game. Okay, but these guys, von Neumann and Morgan Stern, first talked about game theory. And so he also, and in doing the game theory, remember in the game theory you have payoff matrices. Those are those numbers. Those are the payoffs. The reason I only give one payoff in chess is what? Because it's a zero-sum game. If it's too good for max, it's minus too good for min. That's what it is. So that's why you don't need to give two numbers if it's a zero-sum game. Okay, so they had to talk about when can you convert preferences over outcomes of games, let's say, into real numbers, and they had to do this. Okay, so that's the deal. Now, so that's the background, and then so if utilities can map to real numbers, now the question is what real numbers? All they say is there exists a mapping of lotteries and events to numbers such that everything would be corresponding. Now the question is, what are those? They don't tell you how to do it, but there are ways. So this is basically a utility elicitation problem, okay, at the atomic level. And it becomes more interesting at the structured level. In atomic level, so in essence, what I'm showing you is, I'm showing you, let's say, your utilities over specific cars. So I'll bring a car and show it in front of you, and say, how much do you like? And get one more car, show it in front of you, how much do you like? And in essence, I need to standardize your liking of each of these cars into some scale. And the usual way they do it, essentially, is I will show you, let's say, if I know a domain enough, then I might be able to know what would be the universally most liked car and universally least liked car. Okay, so, I don't know, I mean, I'll show you a beaten up Ford Pinto or, Yugo. And say, how much do you hate this car? I mean, how much do you like this car? Or they hate this car, and you'll say, maybe zero. That would be zero. And then, I don't know if you are into Ferrari or something, that would be whatever, 10, or maybe 1. You can normalize it. Then I have given you 0 and 1. Okay? Then I will tell you, here I have Rav's Toyota Camry, whose back door doesn't work, has a couple of bumps, and either you get to have this car, or with probability 0.01, you will get Yugo, and probability 0.99, you will get Ferrari Testarossa. Would you like to do this lottery or the sure thing of Rav's car? Right? Okay? And I keep changing the probabilities until you say, I don't see much of a difference. Then I know how to fix the probability, the utility of Rav's car, which is equal to p times the first one plus, basically it's like 1 minus p times 1, if it is 0 and 1. This is the basic idea of fixing utilities. Now again, this is like the Archimedean principle of, lifting the universe. What did Archimedes say? Give me a large enough, a stick and a fulcrum, and I'll be able to lift the universe. Yeah, but it's not going to happen. Right? And similarly, this is the way you're supposed to do it, but it's completely impractical unless you have about 7 states or 7 cars. People will lose interest and move away. But it's at least worth understanding, first principles way, how will you get these numbers? Okay? So, of course, instead of cars, they gave instant death versus continue as before and pay $1.30. Okay? So, it's a different lottery. Okay? Now, of course, if you have no clue as to what you're supposed to do under lotteries, God help you. And in fact, we'll see, much of that chapter, the interesting part of that chapter, for example, is how people can be seen to be irrational in many ways. And it's because they don't necessarily understand probability. Okay? Anyway, so there is this, and then, so the way you normally count utilities is this way, and then the units for the utilities, it depends on the area. If you are in insurance, you can talk in terms of micromorts, which is one death in a million. Okay? Or qualis, which is quality adjusted life years. These are units. You can make up these kinds of units to measure utilities. okay. So with deterministic prices only, the utility is basically ordinal. Okay. Now, one other interesting thing, of course, is everybody thinks money is utility, and they point out that money is not utility. Why? Because it's basically, if I give you a lottery whose expected monetary value is EMVL. So, for example, if I tell you that with probability 0.5 you get $0, and probability 0.5 you get $1,000, that's a lottery. Okay. Now, what is the expected monetary value of this lottery? 500. Now, the question is, I tell you, here is, you have a chance to take part in this lottery, or I'm going to give you some certain money, for sure. How much money do I need to give you such that you don't like that lottery anymore? Clearly, if I give you 600, I'm stupid, you will take it. Right? But I'm trying to give you as little money as possible, right? So, what's interesting is that if it is more than 500, insurance industries don't make sense. If it is less than 500, that means I value certainty. Okay. So in fact, the text points out that apparently they did some testing. You know, somebody did some testing, and many people take $400 for sure. Now, when they say a bird in hand is worth more than two in the bush, how much more worth? This is how much more, right? This is essentially the price for certainty that we are willing to pay. And in fact, the entire insurance industry is based on that, right? For example, when I buy a house, I took part in a lottery. With probability 10 power minus 7, my house goes into flames and I get what, like a minus 100K or something. And with probability 1 minus 10 power minus 7, nothing happens, so I get zero loss. So expected loss of this can be computed. Okay? And basically, I also can say how much am I willing to pay so that I don't need to take part in that lottery. And the difference between what I'm trying to pay, willing to pay, and the EMV is the insurance premium. That's the thing that insurance guys can make me pay. Okay? So that's basically the interesting connection between the money and utility. And it makes sense. I mean, there's nothing, you know, made up about money here. All we are basically saying is that this happens. The reason this happens is because if you were to draw utility with respect to x-axis is money and y-axis is utility, most people's utility function are concave on the positive direction. Okay? And so, in fact, they argue that you would do basically the irrational thing of taking $400 rather than take part in this lottery, which could give you $500, which could be seen as irrational if you think money is utility. But it's not at all irrational if you think that you were at zero. That means you're a grad student, you have about $2 in your hand, right? So 400 is sort of here, and you know, and 500 is sort of here. The rate of increase is reducing. So if you think of a line, you're falling below the line. That's why it's called concave, right? So you would rather give up those $100 and get the $400 for sure, which also means that if Bill Gates were asked the same question, he will take the lottery. Because this guy has 10 billion, which means he's somewhere there, and then 10 billion plus 400, 10 billion plus 500, it's basically a line in that region. So if he still doesn't want to take part in it, he's irrational. Now, of course, he can be rational and not take part in it because there is multi-attribute utility theory. He thinks money is not the only thing. That's a different story. But if money is the only thing, then he should be taking part in that utility. Okay, so tell me an application, of course, other than the insurance companies, tell me an application of EMV being, utility of the lottery being less than the utility of EMV. How many of you guys do eBay? Tell me an example from eBay.
Buy now.
Buy now. What do you think? By now exactly is that, you know, you could take part in the bidding war and pay more or pay less, okay, or just cough up some money and buy now itself. And what are you paying for there? Certainty. Okay, and it again makes sense if this is your utility curve. Okay, and then so I guess we more or less have to stop, but do look at the rest of the slides. You know, if there are questions on these slides, I will talk about next class. There's basically, once you have utilities for states, then you can talk about making decisions based on maximal expected utility. You know, an action which gives you higher expected utility is more rational than the other. And even if in fact, so in this case, you would be using the y-axis to decide what the utility is. By the way, the other thing that this curve explains is why poor people buy lottery tickets and rich people don't buy lottery tickets. This curve explains that and understand why. Okay, the entire lottery system depends on poor people buying lottery tickets, and it's like a reverse taxation. You know, money flows. This is better than Reaganomics, right? I mean, you know, money flows from inner cities into, you know, back hopefully to state treasury. And it's basically because money, your utility, if you don't have any money, then any little money, possibility of getting money means a lot more to you. Whereas if you have a reasonable amount of money, then as the book says, they say that second million is not as interesting as the first million. Apparently these are like professors, so they don't really have that much. Although one of them is a Google guy. So I think, you know, Norwich we can't trust. He has money. Okay, but anyway, so we'll talk a little bit about decision networks and multi-attribute utility theory. Mostly I will do the discussion of multi-attribute utility theory with respect to the second paper. Okay, that's what we'll do. Okay, and then the only thing that's left in this is value of information, which I might do after the second paper is discussed. Okay, so go read the second paper and come back.